Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Sir Ian McKellen and Gemma Arterton on their new film, The Critic, about a cantankerous theatre critic and a struggling actress. The one and only Lily Collins, on the second part of Emily in Paris Season 4, talks to me about how Emily has taken over her life. The great Liv Schreiber talks about playing the cool and shady dad in The Perfect Couple. Plus, we review the week's other new movie releases in the company of Niamh O'Reilly. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. Huge reaction last week to the Beetlejuice interviews with Michael Keaton slagging my Irish accent, and a lot of people enjoyed Willem Dafoe in particular. So great fun. We have a very busy show again this week, as you heard there. So I'm going to have to get straight to it, but I cannot present a movie show and not mention the sad passing of the great James Earl Jones. The most sonorous voice in modern Hollywood, from Darth Vader to The Lion King. He just conveyed epicness in that beautiful voice, and he was a brilliant actor as well, and there don't have time to get into it all, but his role in Field of Dreams as a kind of cantankerous guy opposite Kevin Costner, absolutely brilliant. So RIP James Earl Jones. Now let's get to this.
I have a very important meeting, please make it brief.
I want an apology
for expressing my opinion,
for the manner of its expression, the rudeness, the disrespect.
One of my many solemn duties is to entertain the reader.
At my expense?
Well, it's not just you, is it? I write, what, 500,000 words a year? Oh, mea culpa if 12 of them offended you.
Over the last 10 years, you've compared me to livestock, creatures of the sea, and an extinct bird. You've said my voice is fluting, grating, girlish, and manly. You've described me as plump and emaciated. Which is it, damn you? Last season, her Mrs. Elstead is glamorous but ungainly. She doesn't seem to know how to walk. How to walk? You've been dishing it out to me for a decade and now it's going to stop.
Oh, are you retiring?
Yes, that's a clip from The Critic, where we see Ian McKellen play Jimmy Erskine, a cantankerous and feared theatre critic in 1930s London, who has kind of, he's not out as a gay man, because that was very hard to do in 1930s London, but he's quite, he doesn't really try and hide it at the same time, and has encounters in public parks, which causes the ire of the editor of the family newspaper that he writes for, which is headed by a Viscount Brooke, who's played by Mark Strong. Now, in tandem with this, we have the great Gemma Arterton playing an actress, Nina Land, who's a leading lady, but she's not getting great reviews from Ian McKellen's character. And she's also having an affair with the son-in-law of Mark Strong's, Viscount Brooke, who owns the newspaper. Kind of turns into this kind of quaintish murder mystery of sorts, which involves Gemma and Ian McKellen. And there's some interesting stuff going on about obviously being gay in the 30s, but also this kind of pre-Nazi Germany with the kind of Mosley crowd coming into the UK. This is kind of a Sunday afternoon set in the 1930s, warm watch, even though it's about a murder. There's a kind of cozy feeling to it. Ian McKellen is great as this cantankerous critic, as is Gemma Arterton, as this kind of actress who wants more from her career and certainly more from Ian McKellen. So I got to talk, and I'm not going to give them introductions, to the great Sir Ian McKellen and also Gemma Arterton about The Critic and a bit more besides. Ian, you've been doing this a while, so I assume, despite the great reviews you've gotten over
the years... Excuse me, I should just say, when I picked up my knighthood from the Queen, she dubbed me with the whatnot, with the sword, that's exactly what she said to me. You've been doing this for an awfully long time. And I looked up at her and said, well, not as long as you have, Mark. And was rewarded with a royal smirk and a push away with the hand. Ah. Anyway, enough with all that. Sorry.
So I had the same opener as the Queen. God rest her. That's good to know. But what I was going to say was, in that long career, you've gotten great reviews, but I'm sure along the way, you've taken a hit or two from a critic. So was there a pleasure, a schadenfreude in playing this kind of prickly critic?
Yes. You might have thought it was my chance to take revenge. No. No. He's fortunately larger than the life of most actual critics, or believable as he is in this melodramatic story of great extremes and violence, really. I looked on it as just a wonderful part. If I'd wanted to be have some sort of reaction to a critic, I can perfectly capable of doing that on my own account, and have done. When I was a younger actor, I used to write to critics who criticised me all the time, saying, "Don't you realise that we discarded your notion of the couch in day two of rehearsal, and we've gone way beyond that?" You know, it doesn't get you anywhere, because, of course, they're so cowed by being attacked back that they say, "Oh, I'm sorry, you're absolutely right. You can't get anywhere." So, no, it was just a fantastic part.
Yes, which you carried off very well. Gemma, your character is great in that she's kind of wants to show Jimmy that she has it, you know, that like the art is in her. You just need to open your eyes wider. That's kind of how I saw it. But how do you see her in that way in terms of your relationship with Jimmy?
Yeah, she's an actress that's good, but she's not great. And she's too stifled, really, by her own insecurity, I think. So I think, you know, with Jimmy, he really does pinpoint that. He's also just nasty about her. You know, he gives her unfair criticism about the way she looks and the way she speaks and the sound of her voice and things that are physical.
If she probably wouldn't have done about a male critic, do you think?
Maybe.
I think there's a bit of unwanted viciousness there.
Yeah, he just has it in for her. She does confront him, but that's because also she absolutely idolises him. He was the guy, he was the reason why she decided to be an actress. And I think gaining his approval is, it's almost like gaining your father's approval. You know, he is that figure to her. And I think it's why she's prepared to go so far. I mean, you know, there's some of the things that she has to do, which I can't imagine doing, you know, myself. And she does it in order to gain his approval, but also, you know, to further her career. They have this weird allegiance, and there's a connection that they have. They're both quite messed up people and quite lost. And I think that's, you know, credit to Patrick Marber, because he really allows us to kind of, in the short amount of time, to really see that. They have reasons, their reasons for doing what they do.
They certainly do. Gemma, have you ever called up a critic like Ian talked about?
No, I mean, I just absolutely know. I really admire that, though. I just think it would backfire further down the line, you know. Yeah. It's sort of out, and also don't want to give them the satisfaction of knowing I've read their review and it matters to me. I think, you know, if you, it's your work and it's your, you have to own it. And sometimes it feels pretty awful that someone can tear it apart. You want to be able to confront the person.
The, from what I can tell, these days there aren't in the UK or Ireland or the States, any critics who are writing with that reputation of destroying people's performances. There have been in the past, you know, critics that people read because they could be relied on to say something really horrible, whether it was near the truth or not, about somebody, but not anymore. And I think that's because partly professional critics are losing their power, because everyone is a critic these days with access to worldwide media.
Yeah.
Who needs a review in yesterday's newspaper?
It's funny you say critics, because this is a dovetailing of events. I get criticized on this show because I mention Everton Football Club all the time because I'm a lifelong Toffee. And yet, this movie, one of the producers was the great Bill Kenwright, who sadly passed away 2 years ago, I think it is at this stage, last year, actually. And Ian, you put up a lovely tweet about him saying that when all he ever spoke about when I met him was theatre and Everton. So fine by me. So was he a real flag waver of yours? Was he a supporter of yours, or was he a particular supporter of this movie?
We'd started out at roughly the same time, and he'd had his eye on me, and my only spied him when he'd virtually given up acting. By way of Coronation Street, to become the producer that he was. He employed more members of Equity during his lifetime than any other producer alive or dead. And he didn't perhaps always pay them as much as they deserved. I don't know about that. But the product that he turned out, and of late, he's enjoyed making films. And I've made two for him. Hamlet. I've just played Hamlet.
Yeah,
that was the Bill Kenwright production, filmed in his beloved Theatre Royal in Windsor, and then this one, which was, I think, the last film that he would be actually credited with. Well, of course, when he was with you, he never stopped talking about Everton, and I suspect when he was up in Liverpool, he never stopped talking about the shows he got on in the West End.
Yeah,
and he was a much loved man, and his memorial in the Palladium, I've never heard such enthusiasm, because everyone had a wonderful story to tell about his generosity, actually, and his spirit, and his love of people who were good at their job. Dear, dear man.
Yeah, lovely. Well, I'm sorry we went down an Everton rabbit hole, but I had to bring it up. Yeah. The critic is great, and lovely to see both of you. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Sir Ian McKellen and Gemma Arterton there talking to me about The Critic, and Ian McKellen was talking to me about Bill Kenwright, the former chairman of Everton Football Club. And yes, I did bring up Everton because I had to, because Bill Kenwright financed that movie, or produced it, and it produced a couple of his movies. And as you heard there, Sir Ian McKellen didn't think he paid certain actors enough back in the day. But anyway, they were talking to me, though, ostensibly about The Critic. It was interesting to hear Ian McKellen's take on critics nowadays and how the world probably has no use for them anymore. Oh dear. Not sure if I agree, but maybe their power is waning, as he certainly suggested. So The Critic, I should say, is in cinemas from this Friday, the 13th of September. Now the stars keep coming, because after the break, I'll be talking to Lily Collins. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now take a listen to this.
They're both still staying there, Min. They're jammed in his apartment like a clown car. Look, I know that you've told me to shut up about it so many times, but I don't understand why Gabrielle would let his ex-girlfriend, or his ex-fiance, and her girlfriend, which, by the way, they're back together, to stay with him. It's like he's got a harem in there. I mean, is this a French thing? Is polygamy legal here? Meanwhile, do you know what I saw on my run?
Men. Hot men. Everywhere. Paris is like filled with them. I guess I've just been so focused on Gabrielle and Alfie that I forgot what it feels like to be single. And now that I'm not with either of them,
You're not with Alfie?
Yes, that is a clip from Emily in Paris, the fourth season. The part two of the fourth season just landed on Netflix this very week. If you're not familiar with Emily in Paris, the four-season strong romantic comedy sees Emily, a 20-something American, move to Paris to work in marketing and live out her best life with lovely outfits, daily pastries, plus very little worries about how she affords this lavish lifestyle, similar to Carrie Bradshaw in Sex and the City. And I make that comparison because it is from the same brain as gave a Sex and the City, Darren Star. Now, you know, this has divided people in that some people absolutely hate this, but the lovers of it, and there are many, millions of them, claim it's a charming piece of escapism. And I'm kind of with them. It's not going to change your life, but it's highly enjoyable and it's utterly bingeable for people who are into this kind of thing. And as I say, people do love it. Now, at the start of season four, Emily, played by Lily Collins, is newly single before her British boyfriend Alfie comes back on the scene. And she also is in this kind of menage a trois, is overstating it, but all through the season so far, she's had this on and off thing with her attractive French chef friend who's still in love with her after all these years. And he was jilted by his fiancée Camille in the dramatic season three finale when she admits she can't marry him because he's in love with Emily. She also forgot to disclose the fact that she was sleeping with her own best friend Sophie. So it's all very French and entangled love lives, and it's all taking place in Paris. And in season four, part two, the action moves to Rome, which is rather exciting for fans of the series because Rome looks delightful in it as well. As I say, Lily Collins plays Emily, who has been acting literally since about the age of two. I can't give you all her credits. You know who she is. She's famously the daughter of Phil Collins, although that in a way has nothing to do with anything anymore because she's been in everything from To the Bone, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, Tolkien, Mank, which I spoke to her about a few years ago. A powerhouse of acting at this stage of her young life. And I spoke to her earlier in the week about Emily in Paris.
Hello, how are you?
Very nice to see you. I spoke to you from Mank.
Oh my gosh, amazing. Okay, hi.
Hi. So listen, you know, it's great you get to go off to France every year and be in Paris. I wonder when seasons four script comes in and you see you get to go to Rome as well, where you're like, God, I have the best job in the world.
Darren teased this to me. He said the goal, the dream a few years ago would be that we end up going to Rome for an adventure. And I was like, let's see if that happens. And then this season when he said it was, I was so excited because I've been here before, but I'd never sure. worked here, but I'd also never fully experienced it like you would in a show. So I was excited to have the same experience like we had had with Emily in Paris, but like Emily in Rome and seeing what that would bring.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this. I was reading, I've watched all the show, but I was reading about it today in various places. And so much is made of the fashion. So much is made even of your hair and how, like, you know, from bangs to, and like, you know, we live in a world now where we're trying to almost focus less on people's appearance, particularly women, because it has traditionally been so not fair to them. And I was thinking, you know, it must, or is it hard on you that so much of what's written about the show is focused on you and also how you look? Like, it must be tough at times, but I guess you've signed up for that, so you know what's involved.
I mean, when I signed on for the show and I knew that Patricia Field was a part of it with Darren Star, and I had watched so many shows they'd collaborated on before, I was just excited because I admire Patricia so much and I just love her work. And so I just knew fashion would be a really big influence on the show. Cut to 5 years and four seasons later, and Marilyn Fattusi is, to me, an absolute genius. And if we get to celebrate her and her team and her work through the fashion, and then we get to celebrate the hair and makeup department and my team, Mike and O'Reilly, who I've been with since day one, then I'm so grateful that they get to have their craft celebrated. And I'm just kind of the vessel through which they get to play around. And honestly, I like don't even look in the mirror sometimes. I'm like, you guys do your thing. We'll play around. And like, what do you want to try today? And I think it's really important to celebrate and pay attention to the department heads who make our show our show. We've got the production design, and then we have the fashion and the hair and makeup. And sometimes it, you know, yes, sometimes it can feel like, oh, wow, it's like, this is a lot. But at the end of the day, I'm just so happy to be around these people, and I love fashion, and I love hair and makeup. Like, but I don't want it to always be just that, because the story this year specifically, like, there's more vulnerability, you know? And I think season one, we didn't know who Emily was, so we had to show it through the costumes and through hair and makeup more so that you could just see her on screen and know who she was. Whereas this year, you know her now for four seasons, it can be pared down a little bit and she can actually emote and feel more.
Tell me this, even though you're a very famous actress, I nearly called you Emily when you came on screen, right? And, you know, I mentioned to you that I spoke to you for Mank. Right. And I remember after I did that interview, I said to a couple of people in the radio station I work in, oh, I spoke to Lily Collins. And they were like, did you ask about Emily in Paris? And I was like, what's that? And here we are 4 years later. And it's like taken over and it's been huge numbers and all that kind of stuff. Has it taken over your life in a way?
It's very much been it's obviously been such a huge part of my life. And it's interesting now to look back on the last 5 years and I think in terms of, was I shooting or not shooting the show when that happened? Because so much of my life has now been interwoven with that in a beautiful way, but it's become this like passage of time. I will say a lot of people, I mean, Emily and Lily, they're pretty similar. I get it, but a lot of people do call me Emily. And then they, Lily. I never thought I'd be a part of something that would become this. You know, I think it's such a blessing and it's something that's brought me to Rome and there's so many amazing things that have come from it. And at the end of the day, to be a part of something that provides people with an escapism and a joy, that's a huge gift, you know? And I would never say it's taken over my life. I just say it's become and impacted so much of my life.
I guess you're marking your own life. Was I in Emily Paris or not at the time? I get it. It's great to talk to you again and continued success.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Nice to see you again.
Cheers.
Bye.
Lily Collins there chatting to me about how Emily in Paris is or isn't taking over her life. And part two of season four is now on Netflix. And as I say, if you like Emily in Paris, well, season four, part two will do the business for you and then some, because it's in Rome and Rome looks the way Paris looks in Emily in Paris, if you know what I mean by that. Now, also on Netflix, which we spoke about last week and we spoke about it on the Pat Kenny Show this week, is The Perfect Couple, which some people, again, are loving and some people really are enjoying. And that was borne out when I was talking to Anton Savage, who was in for Pat Kenny this week, and we were talking about The Perfect Couple and texts were utterly divided, 50-50. Some people saying it was utterly bingeable, really enjoyable. Other people saying it was dross. I think it's great. In case you missed last week's show or you don't know about The Perfect Couple, it's a murder mystery taking place in a very lavish wedding on Nantucket, where Nicole Kidman plays the matriarch of a family, a very rich, wealthy family with desperate secrets, and they're all quite waspish. Our own Eve Hewson, who was on the show last week along with Jack Rayner, is marrying in to this waspish family. And this week, I wanted to bring in my chat with the great Liev Schreiber, who we know from Ray Donovan and all sorts of other things. He plays the dad, Tag, husband of Nicole Kidman's Greer Garrison Winbury in this, who's, you know, quite fanciable by a lot of people in this, but he's goes around smoking dope and drinking whiskey all day and clearly has a lot of secrets to hide. But he's great in this as the patriarch, the down at heel patriarch, who doesn't seem to have worked but has lots of money. Now, I spoke to him and also the youngest of their children, Will Winbury, in this, Benji's younger brother. Benji's the guy Eve Hewson is marrying. He's played by Sam Nivola, the son of an actress, Alessandro Nivola, who was in Many Saints of Newark, a great actor as well, and in Face Off and things like that. And Sam plays Will Winbury, who's the youngest of the Winbury children, who's kind of seems like he doesn't have much to do in the story, but then things change a lot as the show goes on. So I want to bring you my chat with Liev Schreiber and Sam Nivola talking about The Perfect Couple. And I spoke to them, I did this interview last week, and we chatted about, you know, the start of their working day, let's say.
Hey, John.
How's it going? How are you?
It's going all right. It's a first day. We're all still ebullient.
Yeah.
Enjoying ourselves.
Exactly.
Ebullient. That's a great start. If anyone's ebullient, you know you're going to have a good interview. Yeah.
Well, the first day of a junk, it's always ebullient. Day three, it's a little different.
Well, I'll try and keep the ebullience going. It's a miserable day here in Dublin, Ireland, so it's nice for me to talk to you. Liev, if I can start with you, I gather you were Now, you may have been humorous, but you were kind of bullied into this in a way that your initial reaction wasn't that I can't wait to do this, but then you were talked around to it. Is that right?
Yeah. I don't know if you've met Susanna.
I have before.
But she's very intimidating, very, very, very intimidating woman. But I had it. We spoke for about 2 weeks on the phone, and she, bully is a word that when we get into the actual litigation around this film, I probably won't use. But coerced is a better word. And Nicole's a dear friend. I've known her for years, and she coerced me as well to strong women.
Yeah, well, I'm awfully glad they did because it worked out well. Sam, I gather again from the notes, and I have watched the whole series, by the way, but just in terms of you getting into the character, you had some relations out in like East Hampton or the rich part of Long Island, and you kind of tapped into that to get a sense of who your character might be.
Yeah, I did. I mean, so my great-grandparents fled the Holocaust and moved right to Springs, East Hampton in 1943 or something. My family have had that same house ever since. So yeah, it's that part of the world has changed a lot in the past, however many, 20 years since I've been alive. But it's for sure similar groups of people hang out there and in Cape Cod and on Martha's Vineyard, and they're very interesting. They're sort of despicable, but really fascinating to watch and sit on the beach with and have a $12 espresso next to.
The connection between Holocaust survivors and American aristocracy
was really
stunning that you actually managed to find your way
find
back
that
to
loop.
That one. That
was really good. It all starts somewhere.
Entitled people. Yeah, I think that was a big theme of this show, is the entitled people. And there is this world of American aristocracy in Nantucket that is actually kind of, the antithesis of Holocaust survivors. But but still that thing, like, of people who, we think we want what they have until we see what they have. Mm-hmm. And what's so wonderful about Susanna is the sort of very dark and Scandinavian way, her perspective on that, her take on that, the black comedy of it was really fun. And I should say that was what our talks were about. Those 2 weeks I had been a huge fan of hers, and discovering her sensibility around this subject of American aristocracy and how completely perverse it was really delightful, and the coercion that got me on the film, at least.
Yeah, it's funny because in Ireland and this part of the world, we're older in some senses, and we don't think of America as having aristocracy, but your show clearly shows that it does. I was thinking, not to throw around Tolstoy too early in the morning, but he says this great thing about, every family is tragic in its own unique way. And in a way, despite all the money and the Nantucketness of it, it's still a story about a dysfunctional family, which we all come from, to bigger or smaller degrees, or would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, like what you were just saying about the family being entitled. I think that's certainly true, but the thing that they, like what you were just saying, is that they're not entitled, they're self-entitling. They don't have aristocratic titles in the same way that they do in the UK and in these older countries that in which the aristocracy is viewed by some people as actually relatively classy, and there's this sense of not needing to prove yourself if you are a lord or whatever in England or elsewhere in Europe. But the interesting thing I think about the American aristocracy is that they're completely self-entitled, and they have to do a lot of work to maintain the perception that they have something in common with this group of people in Europe who are like supposedly divinely entitled, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think we do have aristocracy in America. We have names that go back hundreds of years, and those people have claims to great fortunes and land, and are the sort of typically the derogatory word is WASPs.
Yeah,
it's a community of people who are entitled to their names and what they've inherited. And I think you're right. We all have our dysfunctions. All families. I mean, I love that Tolstoy quote. But I think that there are certain impediments that wealth brings.
Sure.
In other words, learning to do something for yourself is a great is a great igniter of ambition and success and determination. Whereas if you're I think there's a certain, at least what I enjoyed about this piece is there's a comedy around people who have inherited wealth and who have inherited that is darkly humanistic and compelling.
Yeah. And Liev, one of the things I've noticed about you and other things I've seen you in, and I've seen you in things all the way back to the Day Trippers, you'll be pleased to hear, is that you have a kind of inscrutability about you. And I saw it in this one as well, in The Perfect Couple, that this guy is either going to shake my hand or punch me in the face. I don't know where he's going to go. Have people said that to you before about you? And I mean it as a compliment, but that you're hard to read. Have other people suggested that to you?
Yes. Many people
Good.
Have said that I'm hard to
Really?
Read. Mostly to my detriment. But
but it's a gift as an actor, I guess.
Well, I think with characters like this, you know, what on paper what's happening is so horrible in so many ways. But I think your job as an actor is to kind of find the antithesis or find the other side of it.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've always liked about acting and great writing, really great writing, is that there's duality. And so when something leads a little too heavily in one direction, it's always a good idea to find out where that person's balance is on the other side.
Yeah, very good.
More often than not, so.
Well, it's working for you. And Sam, just really briefly, I spoke to your dad 2 years ago for a movie, and I was just thinking,
oh, no way.
Yeah, for The Many Saints of Newark. You look a lot like him, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I don't like to bring up people's parents when they're making their own way in the world and famous dads, but it's just, I often find it strange that, and I was talking to a previous actor only this morning, Isham, whose parents are both actors. And I wonder, you know, sometimes people have parents who do stuff and you're like, that's the last thing I want to do. So I'm just wondering, did that affect you a lot, seeing your dad go out to work, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my parents strongly advised me not to become an actor. Of course, I feel incredibly lucky and grateful to be in the position I'm in and to be able to work with people like Liev, whose work I've admired my whole life, is just such an amazingly lucky gift. But there are parts of it that are incredibly difficult, and you know, I have also seen it firsthand growing up that it's hard also to have a family and to make time for each other and the people you love when you're bouncing all around the world. But I think my parents knew that, like, that I was smart enough to see that, like, I grew up sharing in a lot of the problems that they felt with the film industry. And I knew what I was getting myself into, you know, but he's amazing. Yeah. He's at the Venice Film Festival right now promoting his movie called The Brutalist, which you should watch, because he is brilliant in it, and I'm incredibly proud of him.
Well, the apple didn't fall far from the tree and all that stuff. And Leave, you're great as always. So lovely to talk to you. And sorry to throw around Tolstoy so early in the morning, but I'm a prisoner of my own intellect or whatever. You
we're
know?
Gonna Thanks use it.
Don't.
What's the exact quote?
I think
every family has their own tragedy.
No, every family is tragic in its own unique way. That's more or less it.
Thank you.
Liev Schreiber there, and Sam Nivola talking to me about The Perfect Couple and a Tolstoy quote, which I've paraphrased. It's not the exact words of it, but the sentiment is exactly the same. And they were talking to me about The Perfect Couple, which is going gangbusters on Netflix at the moment, I have to say. Even though it is dividing people, I think it's very bingeable. Watch a really good, sunny yet dark Nantucket set murder mystery. Up next, the week's new movie releases in the company of Niamh O'Reilly. Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. We are going to turn to the other week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is the new James McAvoy movie. Well, there's other people in it too, called Speak No Evil, and a movie on Sky Cinema that is getting a cinema release called Lee, where Kate Winslet plays a war photographer. Delighted to be joined now by freelance writer, journalist and movie buff. I'll keep going. She wants me to go longer, longer. I don't know.
Yes.
Niamh O'Reilly, how are you?
I'm really good. This is a good week for films, I think.
Yes.
So that always puts me in good humour.
Yes, indeed it does. Indeed it does. So, Speak No Evil. I haven't seen this, unfortunately, but this is, you know, a middle-class nightmare where you meet your friend, you meet couples on holidays. Not that I'm ever invited, but apparently lots of people go and meet up with people. So that's kind of the basis of this movie.
It is. It is a remake of a 2022 Danish film, which translated means The Guests. So it's very, very good. It's very tense. And James McAvoy is terrific in this. So you're right. The setup is we have Scoot McNairy, who you might remember from Argo a good few years ago, and various other things. He's a good character
actor.
Yeah,
he's a real... God, I know that guy from somewhere.
Yeah, you will know his face.
Yeah.
So he's playing Ben, and his wife is played by Mackenzie Davis. She's Louise. And they are Americans who have recently moved to London to live. But they're on holiday in Tuscany at the start of the film with their daughter, Agnes. And they're very sort of very middle, upper middle class, very woke, very...
You had me at Tuscany.
Very sort of PC kind of people, very reserved. And they're enjoying their holiday, and up rocks James McAvoy and his wife, played by Aisling Francosi, a brilliant Irish actress, and they're playing Paddy and Kira.
Well, she's Irish. I didn't know
she is. She's Irish-Italian. Yeah,
okay.
She was in a fantastic film called The Nightingale.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix.
Yes, I know her now. Yes.
Very disturbing, but she's terrific in it. She was also in The Fall.
Oh, yes, that brilliant Northern Ireland drama.
Yeah, so she's in this and she's playing his wife, Kira. So they rock up to this hotel, which is very peaceful, very calm. And he rocks up in a big, like, Hawaiian shirt, and he bombs into the pool, and he's loud and he's brash, and he's ordering beer at like 11 o'clock. So very opposite to Ben and Louise. Mm. But they strike up a friendship and they kind of become friends on holiday, as you do. It's very relatable. And then when Ben and Louise get home, they get a postcard from Kira and Paddy saying, come and visit us. You know, we live in this lovely farm in the West Country. Come for a long weekend.
In the UK, the West Country.
In the UK, yeah. And come and stay, you know. And normally, like, it's very relatable. Like, people meet people on holidays and say, yeah, let's meet up afterwards. But we very rarely do it. But Ben and Louise, there is some trouble in the marriage, I would say, that's kind of hinted at. And also their daughter, Agnes, she's very anxious. She does a lot of deep breathing with her mum when she gets anxious. She still has a teddy bear, even though she's 12. And her dad really wants to get her out of this. She really wants her to grow up and sort of put this behind her. So they reckon this might do them good to go for a long weekend. So they head off to the farm to stay with Kira and Paddy and their son, Ant, I should say, who is mute, really, for want of a better word. He has a problem with his tongue and he's not able to speak properly. So they arrive and things start to fall apart very quickly when they get there.
And Paddy and his wife's name again Kira. Is, they're kind of intense, aren't they? Like I saw in one of the clips, they start reprimanding the other person's child for not eating their vegetables.
Yeah, so the thing about this film, I think within the first few seconds of this film, it's very clear to the audience that there is something off about this family, about Kira and Paddy. And it's hard to put your finger on what it is. They are loud, they are brash. Paddy is very, like, James McAvoy is in incredible shape in this. He's literally bursting out of his clothes. I mean, Arnie-level muscles.
Pumped, yeah.
And he's not a tall guy, but he is incredibly imposing in this. Very toxic, alpha male type of character. And there's something off about them. But sort of the other couple ignore it, for want of a better word, on holidays. But when they arrive at the farm, it is obvious to us as the viewer what is going to happen and where this film is going to go. I mean, it's blatantly obvious. And I think on some level, Ben and Louise know that too.
Okay.
But the theme of the film is very much about this idea that in order to avoid being seen as rude or impolite or to avoid awkwardness, many of us go against that gut instinct, those red flags going off in our head saying, this doesn't feel right, this is wrong, I should get out of here. But they don't, because they don't want to be awkward. They don't want to leave. They've just arrived.
And is the point of the movie then that we're doing this more and more as society goes on because we have all these middle-class faux friendships?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's
really, really, really magnified. And James McAvoy's character has such fun here. He starts off with these little microaggressions towards Ben and Louise. Louise is a vegetarian. And on their first night, he, you know, declares, oh, I've shot our finest duck and I've cooked it. And he cuts a bit off and insists that she tastes it, knowing that she is a vegetarian. And she goes along with it. And it's these little microaggressions that by the end of the film become macroaggressions.
Right,
and what you might have seen in the trailer, reprimanding someone else's child and saying, you know, things that normally, I mean, you would stop and say, hold on, you can't say that, you can't do that. Or say, I'm a vegetarian, I'm not eating this duck. But to avoid seeming rude or to avoid awkwardness, they go along with it. And I think it's really relatable because as a woman, for example, there are times when you might be in a situation late at night, someone, you might think someone's following you or you're in a conversation with someone and it doesn't feel right, but you don't want to upset the apple cart. Or you think, if I just smile and go along with this, everything will be fine.
And I know there's no supernatural dimension to this, but it's suspenseful. Slightly horror-ish?
It's incredibly suspenseful.
Maybe it isn't horror at all.
I wouldn't call it horror. No. It is from Blumhouse, who are really well known for their horror and their thrillers. This is a classic thriller. I was sitting watching this with my arms folded. Like, my body was incredibly tense for, I would say, 90% of the film. Like, it's really well done. And as I said, we know what's going to happen, but it doesn't water down the intensity.
Because the protagonists don't know what's going to happen.
Or no, I think on some level they do.
Okay.
But the thing is, you don't know when James McAvoy is going to drop the facade and when the truth is going to come out. And there's a few red herrings in that regard that actually are quite well done and adds a bit of dark
humor to it. I
really
like the sound of this. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about Speak No Evil. By the way, it was called The Guests in Danish. I prefer that title. I think Speak No Evil just sounds a bit generic. Like I was even checking the name. Is it Speak No Evil? Is it Hear No Evil?
I know, I got confused myself. Yeah. Yeah, I think The Guests would have been better. But I think the thing with this film is they've put their own stamp on it very much. It's very Blumhouse and it's very polished and it's very glossed. And the ending differs from the original.
Okay. Satisfying ending?
It's very satisfying. The whole film, I think, is quite similar to Funny Games, which one that was out.
Michael Haneke.
Well, there was a remake then with Naomi Watts.
Sorry, I meant the original French one.
Yeah, of course. So it's quite similar in tone to that. But
middle class suburban horror, even though this isn't suburban.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And not horror, but, you know, terrifying.
No, it's not horror. But the last portion of the film differs from the original. And the original, if anyone has seen it, it's very bleak and it's very disturbing. So this is changed completely, the ending in this one. And it's very similar to Straw Dogs, that kind of vibe to it.
This sounds intriguing.
It's really good.
What are you going to say stars-wise for Speak No Evil?
I'm going to say, despite the fact that you could say it's predictable, but I think that's the point. I think it's making a point by doing that. I'm going to say 4 stars.
4 stars. Excellent. So that's 4 stars for Speak No Evil, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 13th of September. Neve O'Reilly is giving it 4 stars. Let's take a quick clip.
Paddy, can you come take a look at this?
Yeah, sure.
God, there's a doctor in the house.
I'm not a doctor.
What?
Well, didn't you say you were a doctor?
Did I?
In Italy, you...
No. Sometimes when I meet new people, I'll get a little bit self-conscious. You know?
I just wanted to make a good impression.
Yeah.
What do you do then?
I don't do anything.
Like, anything?
No, I don't work. I don't believe in it. Let's get that fixed. Where's the plasters? Look at their faces.
We should have taken a picture.
Of course I'm a bloody doctor. We totally had you, right? How else could we afford all this?
That was a clip of Speak No Evil on general release from this Friday, the 13th of September, and Eve O'Reilly gave it 4 stars. Now, something very different, which I have seen, is Lee, which is a Sky Cinema movie, but it's going straight to the cinemas.
Yes.
And we have Kate Winslet playing renowned, I think it's fair to say, model turned war photographer, an unusual career trajectory, certainly for that time, in Lee Miller. So tell us what's going on. And Kate Winslet, of course, starts.
Yes, Kate Winslet is playing Lee Miller. So this is a very by-the-numbers biopic. there's no other way to say it. It's not reinventing the wheel here. And it kind of focuses on the period of Lee's life from just before the start of World War II and focuses very much on the work that she did in terms of her photojournalism, which, you know, it wouldn't be understating it to say they were some absolutely incredible photographs that I think we've forgotten about in recent times. She was one of the first photographers to document what happened in Dachau and Bergen-Belsen and those awful trains. And when the film gets to those portions, it's really very affecting. And it's done very well in that we sort of see the frames through the shots that she took. So that's very well done. So the film opens in 1938. The war has not started yet. And she is in France hanging out with her arty, writery bohemian.
And she's living free and easy.
Like, she had the most incredible life, the sort of life that normal people like you and I can only dream of. Like, travel and hanging out with poets and artists and just, you know, doing amazing things. And it's the sort of hang out where, like, she sits down at this picnic and, like, takes her top off immediately. So it's very relaxed.
Yeah, very.
At this picnic, she meets an artist called Roland, played by Alexander Skarsgård, and they hit it off. And then the film flashes forward and they're living in London. They've got married and the war has started. And she gets a job as a photographer for Vogue in London. And at the start, she's kind of documenting women on the home front and what they're doing and their efforts. But she is really... She has this desire to get to the front and to document what's actually happening, but she encounters an awful lot of sexism, obviously. You know, she's told women don't go to the front, you know. But anyway, she wangles her way there and is sort of kept on the edges at the start. She's sort of around kind of the medical tents and stuff, which is horrific enough in itself. You know, men are getting limbs amputated and there's a lot of horror to be found there. But and she documents that. Eventually, she gets sent to where the action is. And that's, I think, really when the film finds its stride, I think.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you when you say by the numbers, because they use this kind of framing device where she's being interviewed about her life and stuff. But, and it's your review, but it is completely by the numbers and you kind of knew what was going to happen. All. But the standout, like Kate Winslet is, and she's always brilliant, but she's great in this, I think. Vulnerable, feisty, sometimes scared, like everything, the full gamut of emotion. She can do it all.
She can. And I think Lee Miller was a very complex character because she was this amazing photographer. And I think on the outside, she was confident and, you know, she was carefree. And, you know, at the beginning, she says something like, I'm good at three things, taking pictures and sleeping with people. And I can't remember what the third
drink
one is.
Was the
drinking.
Other one.
So outwardly, very confident sort of person, but she actually, if you know, you go back and read up about her, she had a very, very traumatic event happen to her in her early childhood, and that is hinted at a little bit through the film and through some of her actions. She's quite protective of young women that she comes across during the war who are perhaps being assaulted by men and stuff like that. So that is kind of described then later in the film, revealed later in the film why she's like that. And, you know, it shows a complete other side to this outwardly confident person. But I still think the film just doesn't go deep enough. It doesn't really scratch the surface because it's focusing on this one period, I think, of her life. And that's fair enough. You can never fit someone's whole life into a biopic. And when you try, they often fail.
Yeah.
But I think they could have done more in terms of maybe flashbacks or something a little different than just the character older recalling their story to somebody.
There's no huge creativity with the storytelling arc or anything like that.
It's,
but as you say, like the scenes in the concentration camp are very poignantly handled, and she's great in it. I thought Alex Skarsgård was
Alexander.
Yeah. Yes, Alex. I think I've interviewed him. His part was kind of it was kind of beige, wasn't it? He was underwritten as her husband, but maybe
a footnote in it, really. And they are separated, I suppose, by the war in it. So their relationship wasn't great. I thought the relationship that was brilliant was the life. She meets a photographer called Davy Sherman.
Yeah.
And she has a fantastic central relationship with him. And I think it's fair to say, he's played by Andy Samberg, sorry. Mm. I think it's fair to say that he had stronger feelings for her than she did for him. But they have a fantastic central relationship.
Andrea Riseborough playing her editor in Vogue is,
Audrey Withers,
is good, but it's a short place.
But I think they do have a nice back and forth in that, and they do have a lovely moment towards the end when Lee kind of reveals this traumatic incident that happened to her as a very young child, and it's really the first time she's spoken about it, and she chooses Audrey to share this with. But yeah, look, it's beautifully shot. I think seeing this in the cinema will certainly change, you know, how you experience it. I saw it on a laptop, which wasn't ideal. So I think on the big screen, it's going to look good. And the scene, I should say, if anyone is familiar with Lee Miller's work, she has a very famous photograph of her in Hitler's bathtub taking a bath. And that scene I thought was terrifically done. The build up to that is wonderful, and it's quite tense.
Yeah.
She's taken off her muddy boots.
Yeah.
You know, she's just been to the concentration camps. The mud on her boots is from there, and she gets into the bath, you know, that probably relatively recently Hitler was in. It's a very provocative photograph, and it's done perfectly.
Yeah.
It's a really, really good moment, I think.
There should have been more moments like that maybe in it.
I think.
But that said, it probably gets by, I'm putting words in your mouth, by the strength of its central performance.
It
so what would you say stars-wise for me?
I would say 3 is probably fair, based mainly, as you say, on Kate Winslet's performance. She's really good in this, and I think her as an actress, I think in the last number of years, she's really come into her own. Like, she's 48, and traditionally, you know, this was the time when roles dried up for actresses, but she is she's a breath of fresh air. She's so honest and upfront.
Absolutely.
She doesn't take any crap, and I think she's really coming into her own, and she is the best thing in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And if she does nothing else in her life, the fact that she played that role in Mayor of Easttown for me is a crowning achievement of her career. And everything else I've seen
brilliant.
Her in, she is amazing.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, go back and watch.
She is brilliant in Lee, but the movie around her is only so, but it does get by. Niamh O'Reilly is giving it 3. I would wholeheartedly concur. So that's 3 for Lee, which is kind of a biopic of the photographer Lee Miller, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 13th of September. Niamh, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mill.
Niamh O'Reilly there, talking about Lee, which is in cinemas, as is Speak No Evil, which sounds like the better of the two movies, it has to be said. That is it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane and Stephen Daunt, who helped out on the show. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. Or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Next week on the show, I'll be talking to Elizabeth Olsen about a new movie, His 3 Daughters. That's all to come next week. In the meantime, I'll just wish you a happy remainder to your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.